We're pleased on behalf of Torah Moshe. I want to welcome everybody to the third of our fourth part series. And it's a pleasure to have once again Shuli Mishkin from Alon Shvut Israel. And these virtual tours are almost as good as the real thing, not quite as good. I know Doma Shmuel Ariya, but please God, one day we can, those who are not in Israel can get back. And we want to thank you and look forward to part three. Bakasha, Bakasha Shuli.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Welcome back to people who are coming back. Welcome to new people. I'm Shuli Mishkin. Last time we talked about the Plishtim, but today we're going to do almost a part two of what we did in the very first session, where we talked about King David and the reality of King David, meaning what does the archaeology say versus what does the Tanakh say. And today we're going to talk about King Solomon and his empire. So just to get us started, before we even go into the PowerPoint, okay, we have in Sefer Melachim Aleph, right, in the first book of Kings, we have a whole description of King Solomon's kingdom and how much food he needs to feed all the people at his table. Right? And I'll just read you one pasuk that I think is very emblematic of what the Tanakh is trying to show about King Solomon. Right? We are in the fifth chapter, the fifth pasuk. Vayeshev Yehuda v'Yisrael ha-betach, ish tachat gafno v'tachat te'enato midan v'ad be'er-sheva kol yimei Shlomo. And Judah and Israel were all secure, each person under his vine and his fig tree, right? This classic imagery of peace is when you can sit peacefully under your vine and under your fig tree from Dan until Be'er-sheva, all the days of King Solomon. And we have also a description of his very vast kingdom and how incredibly powerful he is. And that's really what we're going to try and explore today. Does archaeology back that up? Does it contradict it? Or, and if you've been to the first two, you know that I'm going to say, it's somewhere in between, okay? So we have this question and we addressed it a little bit in the introduction in the first session where we talked about archaeology and how they related to Tanakh, right? And the first archaeologists, certainly the Christians, the believing, the Bible-believing Christians, so people like William Albright, come along and say, we're looking for the truth of Tanakh. Even the early Israeli archaeologists, and the great example here is Yigael Yadin, say, I dig with a Tanakh in one hand and a shovel in the other, and a spade in the other. Meaning, if Tanakh says it, I'm going to find it. The two always go together. And the pendulum swung in the early 80s, 90s, really up until about 15, 20 years ago, in the other direction, right? Saying, no, David and Solomon, mythical figures, or if they existed, small tribal chieftains, everything that's written about Shlomo and about David is really written much later. And it's kind of writing back into history this glorious narrative, right? This almost King Arthur-like legend of beginnings, creating this idealized kingdom, right? With King David, it's the idealized king. With King Solomon, it's the idealized kingdom, stretching throughout the country, north, south, center, cities, as we're going to see. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. It means that it was written later. And one of the people who really is a proponent of this idea is someone named Professor Israel Finkelstein, who talks about how much of what we ascribe to Shlomo is really at least 100 years later to Ahav, who's one of the first Tanakh kings we have a lot of outside evidence about. So we're going to try to weigh those questions and understand, just to get a little bit of a sense of timing, right? The traditional dates that we have for Shlomo, middle of the 10th century before the Common Era, right? 950 or so. Ahav, a little less than 100 years later, okay? 870s, 860s. We're also going to talk a little bit about a king named Yerovam II, who's a little less than 100 years after that, right? And one of the last great kings of the Israelite kingdom. So we're going to try to understand what, where, who. That's what we're going to do in the next hour. Just if you're wondering what the picture is, right, this is a beautiful proto-aeolic column, okay? These are capitals of columns that were found in different places around Israel, always in places that had some connection to royalty, okay? So in Jerusalem, they were found in the city of David, they were found in Ramat Rachel, they were found in Chatzor, they were found in Samaria just recently, this is a very surprising, we don't know what it means. Two of them were discovered on the promenade in Jerusalem. And so far, archaeologists haven't given a great reason what was there, what it might have been. But when you find this, you say, oh, a royal building. Okay, so that's a little bit of a clue. We're going to see it in Hatzor. Is the royal building one that belongs to Solomon or to someone else? So we're really going to spend our time in the three cities that are mentioned in this pasuk. Well, there are four cities, but we're going to talk about the last three, Hatzor, Megiddo, and Gezer. But I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about Jerusalem because you can't talk about King Solomon without Jerusalem. It's just not right. Okay, so here we have the very well-known verse. Again, the Book of Kings, right? King Solomon, we know, is a great taxer. He taxes a lot, but he uses those taxes for projects that people find to be very empowering or constructive. And in fact, when his son Rehoboam comes along and is advised to make the taxes even higher, there's a rebellion because Rehoboam doesn't say, I'm building you a temple, I'm building you a capital city. He just collects the taxes. Shlomo is able to collect them because there's a justification behind it. But what does he use this tax money for? And this is the account of the Levi, right? We're not talking about money, by the way. I'm saying tax money. It's not correct. We're talking about mas avodah, right? Tax labor. You show up and you work for a month for the king, or you pay someone else to do that. Okay? And this is the account of the Levi, which King Solomon raised to build. What is he building? The house of the Lord, the temple, his own house, his palace, the Milo, and the wall of Jerusalem. Okay, Jerusalem is going to expand. We're going to talk about that in a second. All those things are in Jerusalem. And now we have three cities, and Hatzor, and Megiddo, and Gezer. Don't worry, we're going to find out where those cities are. But first of all, let's talk for a minute about Jerusalem. So, and I'm going to just mention, and I mentioned this last time, you can ask any questions you want in the chat. I am not going to look at them until the end. Then I promise I will answer any questions that I am able to answer. So put them in the chat. And if it's anything administrative or super important, Rabbi Kelman will let me know. Okay, so what are we looking at here? We are looking at a picture of a wall in what's called the Ophel excavations. Okay, people with sharp eyes who know their way a little bit around Jerusalem may recognize in the back the Mount of Olives. Okay. So we are basically in the area that's called the Southern Wall Excavations, right? This is if you know your way around Jerusalem, when you come in through Shar HaShbot, the Dung Gate, right? The gate that's closest to the Western Wall. These are the excavations that you pass on your right as you're walking towards the Western Wall. Very important excavations, very important for Second Temple times, but also for First Temple times. And this was already excavated after the Six-Day War by Binyamin Mazar, right, one of the great archaeologists, early archaeologists of Israel. And he's one of the people who's involved in finding the Chulda gates and the steps and all sorts of other things. But he also discovers things from First Temple times. And part two of these excavations were done quite a few years later by his granddaughter, Eilat Mazar, which is a very nice thing, right? The grandfather starts, the granddaughter continues. And she discovers some very interesting things. Her grandfather discovered a building that he says was a royal palace. We're going to see where that is in a minute. A royal palace that dates to the 10th century, to the time of King Solomon. And she finds a wall and a gate that she also ascribes to the time of King Solomon. And that's what this young woman is standing on, right? A 40 meter long wall. You can see, right? It's actually a fascinating wall because it's, you have this wall, right? Made out of these field stones, this First Temple type construction, not the massive stones of Herodian times, right? Behind it, you have another wall. This is the wall from Byzantine times, hundreds and hundreds of years later. They both build the walls in the same place, unaware of each other. Well, the Byzantines are unaware of First Temple times, but it's the most logical place to build a wall. Now, Eilat Mazar is addressing this wall, right, the lower one. And she says, this is the wall that King Solomon builds when he expands the city of Jerusalem. King David establishes his capital in Jerusalem in the little narrow city of David. King Solomon already encompasses the Temple Mount, and he builds a wall around it, connecting to the wall of the city of David. And she says that this wall, that's what we're seeing right here. And we'll continue and take a look. I apologize for the blurriness. It's from a book that I have, and I did not photograph it quite beautifully enough. But it'll do for what we want to see. Okay, here's our wall, right? Here's our wall, and it connects up to this structure, which is what Binyamin Mazar uncovered. Okay, this royal structure. Why is it royal? We'll see in 1 second. Okay, and it connects up to a gatehouse with four chambers. Okay, you see that's going to be very important. Chambered gates in First Temple times. Okay, and then there's another tower. Okay, and another area of an outer gate, which is where the street is today, and you can't see it. Okay, what does all this mean for us? What all this means for us, according to Eilat Mazar, is King Solomon builds this wall around the Temple Mount, and he builds an entryway. Okay, an entryway from an outer gate into an inner gate going into the Temple Mount complex, which is basically up over here. Okay, right next to it, he builds his royal palace. Now, he dates all this to his time, okay, based on the pottery, based on the sizes of the chambers in the gates. They're the same sizes as the chambers that we're going to see in Megiddo, okay, based on various things that she found in the fill, okay, and she claims this is King Solomon, and it shows his building in Jerusalem, and she's challenged. She's definitely challenged. Not that this is not an important site. That's not the challenge. The challenge is it King Solomon's, or is it perhaps 100 years later or even later than that, the time of Uzziah, right? Uzziah, Vayiben, Uzziah, Migdalim, B'Yerushalayim, right? Some people know the song. Uzziah builds towers in Jerusalem. He's another great builder, but he's at least 150 years after King Solomon. So is it King Solomon? Is it not? Very interesting question. The royal structure seems to be King Solomon, because when Binyamin Mazar excavated there, he found pottery fill under the floor, okay? You put something under the floor, that means whatever is built on top of it was built later. And the pottery under the floor is from the 10th century, meaning it's right before the time of King Solomon. So that's what we have from Eilat Mazar. We also have this, well, this is obviously an idealized picture, but based on the text of the temple, okay? And again, the way Tanakh describes the Mikdash, the temple, massive, huge project, tons of manpower, tons of money, uniting people. Where did he get all this metal? And if you know a little of the Gemara, also goes into the crazy amounts of gold that was used, right? Now, here's the fascinating thing. People said, oh no, it could never have been so impressive. Perhaps it never was at all. But there's an excavation that's been going on for the last 15 years or so in Jordan, excavating copper mines, right, from the time of King Solomon. Perhaps King Solomon is bringing the copper to here. So like I said, the discussion is changing from saying, no, it could never have been, to, well, maybe it could have been. More and more proofs that we are finding out. So we're not going to spend any more time in Jerusalem, even though it's always worth spending time in Jerusalem. But we are going to head to our three cities, right? And we're going to see where they are in a second. But just, this is a great project on the internet if you're looking for any kind of pictures or archaeology, the Mada'en project, or multi-denominational, Christians, Muslims, Jews, they have all different kinds of sites. And here they're showing us something that for Yigael Yadin was a very important idea. The three cities that are mentioned in the Pasuk about King Solomon's cities that he built, Gezer, Megiddo, and Hatzor, when they were excavated, each one separately, each one in turn, the gates are the same. The gates are six chambered gates, right? Everybody understands what I say when I say chambers, right? These little gateways, these little rooms inside the gate. Okay, chambered gates are a classic Israelite style. We just saw the four chambers in Jerusalem. You can see them in Tel Sheva. You can see them in different places. What happens at the gate, we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. But this classic style, exactly the same in each one, gives you a sense that there's one urban planner, there's one architect who's doing the whole thing. And Yigael Yadin was so sure of this, by the way, that he excavated in Megiddo, he found these gates, he looked back at the reports from Gezer, and he saw it was the same gate. And when he went to excavate in Hatzor, he drew in the dirt the shape of a six-chambered gate, and he told the workers that that's what they were going to find. And that's what they found. Okay, so for you guys, yeah, Dean, this is proof positive that there was one man behind all these cities. For Professor Finkelstein and other scholars, they say, no. We have six-chambered gates in other places from different times. It doesn't all, you can't use circular reasoning, right? You can't say, well, Shlomo built one six-chambered gate and therefore all of them must be his. So again, we're going to come back to this, but this is definitely something that people use to prove this idea. Here are our three cities, okay? Let's just put in Jerusalem also so we know where Jerusalem is, right? Jerusalem is more or less over here, okay? And we have Gezer, okay? Gezer, again, if you're familiar with the modern map, Gezer is not very far from Latrun, not very far from Modi'in, really the center of the country, but in our three, it's the southernmost one, Megiddo, okay, up in the Jezreel Valley. We're going to see a very strategic place. And Chatzor up in the north, right near Tzfat, right near Tzfat, right near the modern city of Chatzor HaGlili. Why these three? Okay, why these three? What do these three show? Why are they such important cities? So first of all, as you can see, they are all on or very close to what's called the Via Maris, right? The Derech Hayam, the main route that goes from Egypt more or less up the coast, okay, crosses by the Jezreel Valley, and then continues out to the northeast by Chatzor. So these are very important in terms of trade, in terms of soldiers being brought from place to place, right? These are strategic cities. Not only that, Megiddo and Gezer, definitely, Chatzor, perhaps, were not necessarily emptied of Canaanites, meaning in the book of Joshua, Chatzor is conquered and burnt and destroyed. Right? So Chatzor doesn't really fit, but Megiddo and Gezer are very much in Canaanite territory throughout the period of Joshua and the judges and King Saul and even King David. And so for King Solomon to have major cities here, that shows the extent of his power. That shows he has created this united kingdom throughout the whole country, right? So we're gonna start with Gezer. We're gonna work our way north. We're gonna start in the south and work our way north. Gezer is an amazing site, which is definitely not visited enough by people, okay? It's really an incredible place to go, especially when it's not hot outside. Right now, go to Gezer if you have time. Okay, so where are we? Gezer is, like we said, not so far from Jerusalem, right near Modi'in, right in the Ayalon Valley, right? If you remember your book of Joshua, this is where Joshua goes and defends the Gibonim, and then he chases the kings down through the Ayalon Valley, and he makes the sun stand still. Shemesh b'Gibondom, b'Yareach b'Emek Ayalon. There are major roads here, okay? Roads that go out to the coast, roads that go north and south. If you go to Gezer, which is a very beautiful archaeological site that's kind of in the middle of nowhere today. I mean, it's not the middle of nowhere if you drive for 10 minutes in each direction, but you have a lot of beautiful nature around you. You have an incredible view. You can see all the way to the coast. You can see to the mountains. You're clearly in a very strategic place. Now, this tell is excavated already in the early 20th century in 1902 by an archaeologist called McAllister, who recognizes what an important place it is, but he does a lot of damage, and we tend to disparage earlier archaeologists. What did he do, right? You don't have to have a PhD in archaeology to know this was not a good idea. He dug a trench, okay? And then he went to right next to that trench, to the right of it, and he dug a second trench, dumping the dirt from number two into number one. Very, very bad idea. You mix up all the finds. Today, archaeologists are meticulous about having squares of where did everything come from, which square. But McAllister is one of the first ones to really show us this site. By the way, we know, unlike some places where the name was saved, so we remember, you know, we know it because the Arabs kept the name, or other places where we're not 100% sure what the name is. Gezer, we know the name because they actually found a few stones in the fields around, what are called boundary stones, showing that this is the extent of somebody's property. They're from early Second Temple times, right? Hellenistic times from the fourth century or so. And they say on them Gezer, right? So we know that this is Gezer. So we're going to talk about King Solomon, but we want to first talk about Gezer as a Canaanite city. Now, Gezer, Megiddo, and Hazor all were powerful Canaanite cities, right? Very powerful Canaanite cities in the mid-Bronze Age, meaning 2000-ish before the Common Era. And they retain their power, at least Gezer and Megiddo do, for quite a long time. We're looking at the gates coming in together. And again, you can see these chambers, right? They're not only Israelites, right? They were used by the Canaanites as well. It controls the whole area. It's very fertile. It's very significant. One of the things that's great is when you go there, you can see the walls. And can you see the original mud bricks? Okay, these are 4,000-year-old mud bricks. You think mud bricks, how long can they last? They can last a very long time, right? That's why today there's actually even a movement to go back to building with something like this. But mud bricks, right? Those libanim that we make in Egypt, they can last for a very long time. So that's what you see here, the mud bricks in Gezer. They are very strong. But as you continue along, right, you can see the gates of the city. We're going to see the water system in a minute. But one of the things that I think is very powerful, and McAllister found it very powerful as well, is when you come around in the city, really inside the city, you come up on this strange sight, which is these monoliths, right? A total of 10, not all of them survived completely. These standing stones with a basin. Take a look at the picture here on the right. There's a basin next to them. What is this, right? We don't know 100%. When archaeologists don't know things, they say cultic, ritual, right? In this case, it actually makes sense because we know that standing stones, matzevot, right? Think Abraham puts up a matzevah, Yaakov puts up a matzevah. This is something that is used for worship. The basin also, right? Basin is sometimes used as something for sacrifices. It also could be used for a covenant, for a brit. Think about the children of Israel at Mount Sinai, right? They make sacrifices. They have a covenant with God, and they put some of the blood in the basin and some of the blood they sprinkle on themselves, right? The idea of sharing, that's how you do an alliance. That's how you do a covenant. This is from the Canaanite city. Is this some kind of a symbol of a breach of an alliance between cities? Is it some kind of an idol worship site? We really don't know. But what I do think is significant, and we're going to see this also in Megiddo and in Hazor, is that the Canaanite belief system is very powerful. Okay? It's not our topic for today, but it's important to understand when we look at Tanakh, especially let's say at Sefer Shoftim or Eliyahu, and we say, why do they keep falling into this trap of idols? It's such foolishness. Everyone believes in it. It's everywhere. It's very, very pervasive, and it's very hard to go against the trend. Okay, a couple other things from Canaanite Gezer, and we're going to come back to Shlomo. One of the very exciting things that was discovered in Gezer was the Gezer calendar, which if you want to see it, you have to go to Istanbul, because it's one of the things that the Turks took with them, right, in those days where you took things back. But this is what it looks like, and you can see that the letters are a variation on those ancient Hebrew letters. This may be the oldest Hebrew inscription that was ever found in the land of Israel. It's disputed. Is it this? Is it the alphabet from Isbet Sarta? Is it the inscription from Chirbet Kayafa? But in any case, it's a very neat inscription because what is it? It's a calendar, right? And if you look, you can see in the Hebrew or in the English, you have 2 months of each season. Yerach Asif, Yerach Zera, Yerach Lekesh, Yerach Atzad Pishtan, Yerach Ktsar Seorim, Ktsir Tzorim, Yerach Ktsir Bakol, Yerach Zamar, Yerach Ktsir, okay, or Kites, excuse me, Yerach Kites. 2 months of harvest, 2 months of sowing, 2 months of late planting, 2 months of hoeing flax, 1 month of barley harvest, 1 month of harvest and measuring, 2 months of vine pruning, 1 month of summer fruit. This is the farmer's almanac, okay? That's what it is, and it was found in Gezer, and it dates back, right? It dates back to the 10th century, meaning on the cusp between Canaanite and Israelite, but definitely using this Hebrew script. One of the oldest inscriptions that has ever been found. Okay, one last Canaanite thing, and that's this very sophisticated water system that they created, 210-meter-long tunnel, going all the way out to the groundwater, down to the groundwater built by the Canaanites. We're going to see sophisticated water systems in Megiddo and Hazor, but those are Israelite. This is from the Canaanites. This is from earlier times, right? 13th century, 14th century before the Common Era. Even more than that, and it shows you that Gezer is a very powerful city, very powerful Canaanite city. It's a vassal to Paro, but it has its own power, and it lasts for a long time. Even after the conquest of Yoshua, it's still a Canaanite city until along comes Paro, right? Paro, the king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer and burnt it with fire and gave it for a portion unto his daughter, Solomon's wife, right? You thought you were lucky that you got a Mikasa set of china for your wedding. Shlomo got Gezer, right? He got the city from his father-in-law as a gift, right? It's a dowry. It's an interesting point because, again, if you want to talk about the Tanakh creating an idealized picture of King Solomon, then why does he need his father-in-law to give him a city, right? He should be able to get that city by himself. So perhaps this is one of those little things that shows you that this isn't actually a very accurate, very true story. See, right? We're inside the city. We're looking out. The Israelite city is larger than the Canaanite city. It expands outside the borders. And again, you're going to be so sick of this by the end of this lecture. We have our six chambers of our gate, right? Here are our 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 chambers of our gate, okay? And again, we're going to find it in other places. So since we're talking so much about gates, let's just understand for a moment, why is the gate such a big deal? Okay, so here you have another picture of the gate in the chambers where you can see it even better. And the other thing that's very nice in this picture on the right is you can see a drainage channel. Gezer gets a lot of rain. Emek Ayalon gets a lot of rain, and you don't want your city to flood. So a city that's well planned is going to have a drainage channel to go out downhill, out into the fields. And that's exactly what was built here and was uncovered here. What plays the role that the center of town, right, the marketplace or the city plaza, the Rehovot, Vashel Ir is going to play in Second Temple times. Gates are the place where trade happens, right? Merchants are at the gate. We don't want them in our city. You can be at the gate. Religion happens. Ritual happens. You have altars at the gate. Judges sit at the gate. And we have so many sources in Tanakh that you guys can all come up with. Judges and important people, right? Think about Eshet Chayil. Nodaba She'arim Ba'ala, her husband is known at the gates, not that he's sitting and playing poker, but he's one of the elders of the city who's at the gates to the city. Think of Boaz and the story with Ruth happens at the gates. Avraham buys Marat HaMachpelah at the gates. The gates are a very important part of the city, and that's why you need these chambers, right? Why else do you need this? You need it for the guards, but you also need it for all the activities. You need a place for the judges to sit. And in fact, if we do another series, perhaps we'll go to Lachish, where they discovered really great examples of religion and of commerce at the gates to the city. But that's just a basic outline, okay? But our question is Shlomo, right? Is it Shlomo? Is it not Shlomo? So the gates were already excavated earlier, but just recently in the last less than 10 years, there's new excavations that are going on here by a university from the Southern United States in cooperation with the Antiquities Authority here. And they are uncovering right next to the gate a large palace building, or a large building, let's just call it a large building, okay? But it's got a lot of artifacts. It seems to be a palace because it's in such a good location and it's so large, okay? It's massively destroyed, okay, in the 920s or so, which is when we know Paro Shishak comes through the land of Israel and captures and destroys much of the cities there, okay, in the time of Rehoboam. So Gezer is given to us by a Paro, but it's destroyed by a Paro as well. Why is this important? Because if we can date this palace to a little bit before 925 when it's destroyed, then we can date the gates to King Solomon. Okay, so that's a very important thing. We don't have necessarily a definite dating for the gates, but we do have for the palace next door. We're going to come back to our conclusions for all these places, but we have a lot to go, and there might be traffic, so we're going to move along to Megiddo. And Megiddo is really an extraordinary site. It's beautiful. It's in the center of the country. And as you can see, right, the Tell of Megiddo is right here, right? This is the tell up on top. It looks like a classic tell, right? Layers upon layers. We're going to see that in a moment. And it is an incredibly strategic site because it is at the gateway to the Jezreel Valley, right? This road going out here, the gateway to the Jezreel Valley, going out towards the Gilboa Mountains and Har Tabor, and ultimately going out towards the Beit She'an, cutting across the country from west to east. Very, very important. If you control this valley, you control the trade, you control the armies, you control everything. And that's why everybody wants Megiddo, okay? We know already the earliest recorded battles in the land of Israel are Paro Tutmos, okay? 1400 BCE. He comes and he conquers Megiddo. We hear about Megiddo with Sisera in the Book of Judges. We hear about Megiddo with King Saul, with Allenby, right? All over the place up until World War I, like I said, with General Allenby. Megiddo is the place of battle because it's such a strategic site. Okay, let's just take a look at the map for 1 second, even though we pretty much understand where we are. Okay, so here is Megiddo, temporarily closed, tells us Google Maps. Yes, thank you, we know that. Okay, so if I am coming up on the Via Maris, right, on the Sea Road, and now I want to cut across, here I go, through the valley, and you still do it today, right? You still cut across through the valley, passing by Megiddo today. So that is its significance. Also very fertile, lots of water, springs. It's a very good place to have a city. Okay. The tell itself, right? Let's take a look at the tell. It's a very complicated tell because it has many, many periods. Going back to the early bronze, right? We have a Canaanite city, middle bronze, where we have a really powerful Canaanite city. And then we have different periods of an Israelite city. So just while we're looking at this kind of beautiful aerial view of the whole thing, let's just point out a couple of things. Over here on the outskirts is the water system, okay? Israelite water system. We'll see it a little bit later, but a very well-built, very sophisticated water system, okay? Here is the entrance into the city, right? This is the Canaanite gates, the entrance to the Canaanite city. Later on, we have gates that are built in the Israelite city. Are they King Solomon's gates? We will try to answer that question. Okay. We also have areas of palaces. Okay. Two sets of palaces and two sets of stables. Okay, one that's very easy to see, the other one that's definitely harder to see, right over here. So we have stables. Why stables? We'll talk about that. Okay, and then we have a whole part of the city that is built by the Assyrians after they conquer it. So we have a city that is in Canaanite times, in Israelite times, and then when the Assyrians conquer the northern kingdom, conquer the kingdom of Israel, they settle here. Okay, Megiddo is a city that exists for over 3,000 years, okay? It comes to an abrupt end in the 4th century before the Common Era. Nobody really knows why, because it's a great city. Why would you not have a city? But it comes to an abrupt end, but you have 3,000 years of people living in Megiddo, and that's why there's a lot here for archaeologists. We're really going to focus on King Solomon. One other thing I want you to see are the palm trees. You see the palm trees? When you're driving on the road, you see the palm trees everywhere, okay? And the palm trees are fun because why are they there? They are there because the daily snack of the archaeologists who were here in the early part of the 20th century was dates. They ate dates every day for lunch and they threw the pits over their shoulders, and that's why there are palm trees all over the site. So that's just a fun little fact to know. Okay, yes. Har Megiddo, and you go to the national park in Megiddo, you will, well, not today, but in normal times, you will see many, many Christian tour groups that come. Okay. Why are they coming? They're interested in Bible, but it's not only that. Megiddo is Armageddon. Okay. When you hear the word Armageddon, you think of nuclear war. You think of, I don't know, the war to end all wars. But Armageddon is a term from the New Testament talking about this great war that's going to be, you know, at the end of time. What does the word come from? It's a mispronunciation of Har Megiddo. Megiddo is the classic battle site, and it becomes the battle site of the end times for Christians, and that's why it's very important for them to come. And that's why you'll see this is a great picture. This is when in 1964 the Pope visited the land of Israel. It's a very, very significant event. The first time the Vatican comes to the state of Israel. 1964, of course, the old city is in Jordanian hands. So Israel President Shazar, who's the short little Jewish guy here, okay, goes to meet the Pope at Megiddo, right? Megiddo is where the Pope wants to meet him because of the significance to Christians. But why is Megiddo this battle site? Because we have battles here throughout time, Sefer Shoftim, all over the place, and that's really what it becomes identified with. So let's spend a couple minutes on Canaanite Megiddo. Right, we have this beautiful gates, again, our four chamber gates entering into the city. One of the things that's kind of neat, you can see here, okay, this is what's called the restoration line, okay? So everything below it is original, right? Everything above is reconstructed, except you have this strange little line of wood. Okay, now the wood is obviously not 4,000 years old. So why are they putting it here below the reconstruction line? Okay, because there was a gap here. Okay, there was some kind of a fire, or the wood was just organically eaten away. And there was a gap here. And when there's a gap, you know that there was wood. It wasn't mortar, it wasn't stone, because that would have lasted. So when they restored it, they put that gap back. Okay, there were excavations here from the early 20th century. The University of Chicago is here. They take a lot of things home with them. Even before them, you have somebody named Gottlieb Schumacher who comes and excavates here. And then from Israel, you have Yigael Yadin and David Uzishkin, and then Tel Aviv University with Professor Finkelstein excavating here. Canaanite Megiddo was a very, very wealthy city. It's mentioned in the Amarna letters. The Amarna letters are letters that were written to the Paro, right, from various rulers asking for all sorts of things. So Megiddo is one of the cities that writes to the Paro, and it was a very wealthy city. We have these beautiful, beautiful ivory carvings that were discovered from Canaanite Megiddo. It's a crossroads for trade, so there's a lot of money flowing through it. Okay? It's also, like we said with Gezer, an important ritual site. In fact, we have a ritual site that has continuity that continues up until the 12th century, maybe 12th century. Up until the conquest by Yeshua. Maybe, who knows? And you can see in the middle of this ritual site, which has many layers, by the way, this is only one of the layers. They kept on rebuilding temples in the same place. But one of the things that's nice here is you can see a bama, right? A circular altar, which is not Israelite. We're going to see it up close in a minute. Megiddo has more than 30 distinct layers of settlement, which means that it's a great laboratory for archaeology. Here we have some of the ritual, right? Here's our bama with steps. So we have a couple of things that tell you not Israelite. We don't have steps going up to the altar. We have right angles, right? Square altars as opposed to round altars. So this is clearly not an Israelite altar, or not an official or sanctioned Israelite altar. We could put it that way, okay? We also have, there were various idols that were found. Okay, this handsome fellow who looks like he's holding a spatula, he's not making burgers. Okay, this is some kind of perhaps a scepter. Something very similar was just recently found in Lachish. Okay, and it is clearly a ritual center, but we're gonna go to the Israelite city. This is a copy of a seal that was found actually by Gottlieb Schumacher. Sadly, he gave it as a gift to the Turkish Sultan, Abdulhamid II, who we thought, wow, you're going to be so excited by what I'm giving you. Abdulhamid promptly lost it. But fortunately, we have a copy of it. And you can see it's this roaring lion. And it says, Shema Eved Yeravam. Yeravam, who's Yeravam? We have two Yeravams. Yeravam the first, who's the first king of the kingdom of Israel, of the divided kingdom. This is Yeravam the second. Okay, 780s or so, okay, a time of great peace and prosperity in the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah. And so clearly he's here, but we have other people here as well. So here's what we have to understand about Megiddo. It's the one thing you need to understand. And once you get this, you'll be great. Okay, Megiddo, the Israelite city, essentially has two layers. Okay, it has a layer of palaces and a layer of stables. Okay, one is above the other. Whenever you date one, the other is going to be in the next period. What are we going to date them? That, of course, is the million-dollar question. Okay, plus we have a gate, and how do we date that gate? So we have this gate, right? It is a six-chamber gate. I know you're going to say, but I only see three chambers. Don't worry, you'll get that answer in a minute. It's an inner gate. There's an outer gate and an inner gate. What period does it belong to? Right, take a look. First of all, this is the other half of the gate. When the University of Chicago excavated, they took half of the gate back to Chicago. So today you can only see three of the chambers. But this is a style that we know from Israelite times. The wall that it's connected to is a filled-in wall. Now, we have different kinds of walls. We're going to see in Chatzor a casemate wall, which is a wall that the rooms, there are rooms in the wall, there are houses built into the wall. That's a classic Israelite design, an earlier Israelite design. This is a filled-in wall, which seems to be a later style, perhaps Ahav, okay? But there's a seam between the wall and the gate, so the gate could still be earlier. So there are those who say the gate, no, the gate is for sure Ahav. Let's try to just remember our dating, right? Ahav, 850s, 870s, right? There are those many, by the way, very prominent archaeologists like Ami Mazar and Gabi Barkai, who say, no, the gate is King Solomon. The wall might be later, but the gate is King Solomon. So there is a definite distinction, a difference of opinion, but we have very prominent people who will say that the gate is Solomon. Now we come to our other story, right? Like we said, two layers, a city of palaces below, a city of stables on the bottom. Two palaces, two stables, they do not coexist, the palaces and the stables. And here's our debate. Is the earlier layer mid-10th century King Solomon? And then the second layer, the upper layer, is Ahav, who's a very powerful Israelite king. Or do you go with Finkelstein and you say, no, King Solomon was never here. The earlier layer is Ahav. And the later layer is this Yeravam the second, right? That's the debate that we're going to try and understand. The stables being belonging to Ahav, the first theory, it's actually a very powerful one. It's actually very appealing, not only because it shows that King Solomon controls Megiddo, but because it tells us something about Ahav. So that's our debate. And the jury is out. Not everybody agrees. But we have these two sets of stables, okay? First of all, it wasn't always understood that these are stables. The first suggestion was that they are storehouses, but you can see these lovely little troughs, okay? They're actually much, these are reconstructed, obviously, but there are much nicer ones in the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem, where you can actually see the original pillars that have holes in them to tether your horses to them. Now, like I said, the archaeologists didn't officially agree, right, at the beginning that these are stables. They said, maybe these are storehouses. And a volunteer came to Finkelstein at some point, and she said something like, oh, this morning I was excavating by the stables, and he says, her, who told you they're stables? I didn't say they're stables. And she says, listen, you're the top archaeologist. You know everything there is to know about archaeology. But I have been around horses since I was a teenager, and I know what bite marks look like. And these troughs here have bite marks, okay? And they also analyze the soil. And if you know a little bit about horses, you know that horses pee a lot, okay? So the soil was very full of happens when you pee a lot in it. So these are clearly stables, right? Two sets of stables. Now, why are stables important? Because if you have stables, you have horses. Right here are the nice ones from the Rockefeller Museum with the little holes inside to tether your horse to. Here's a little example of a horse in the site in Megiddo. Now, if you have stables, you have horses. And if you have horses, you have chariots. One of the things that the Israelites do not have, and it's why they're not able to take places in the plains like Megiddo, is chariots, right? The Canaanites have Rechev Barzel. This is Sisera in the battle with Barak, right? This is the battles that we have in other places in the book of Judges. They have chariots. They can go across the plains. The Israelites don't, so they can only take the mountains. Chariots are kind of useless in the mountains. They're also useless in the rain. That's the story of Sisera, but that's a different story, okay? But when the Israelites can get horses and chariots, that shows that they have reached a certain level of power. And by the way, Tanakh tells us that about King Solomon, right? He has a whole lot of horses, but the king of the horses and chariots is Ahav, okay? King Ahab. We don't really know that from Tanakh, but we know it from outside sources. In a coalition that Ahab forms with other kings against the Assyrians, he brings hundreds of horses and chariots, okay? He is very, very powerful, and he has a chariot city. Megiddo is a chariot city where you keep your horses, where you keep your chariots. Now, who is the nemesis of Ahab? Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet. Elijah the prophet comes along and he says, I don't care how rich you are or how powerful you are, you don't believe in God and you don't do justice, and therefore you're not going to succeed. And if you remember the powerful ending of the story of Elijah, he's taken away up to heaven in a fiery chariot, okay? And what does his disciple Elisha call out? Avi, Avi, Rechev Yisrael uParashav, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen. Who are the chariots? It's not Ahab and his horses. It's you, Eliyahu, and it's God, okay? It's very much a polemic against Ahab. So if these are Ahab's stables, that's great, because that fits very nicely with our story. Another thing that shows us the power of Israelite Megiddo, and it's a very well organized, very centralized city. This is a massive grain silo that was discovered. It's a little later. It's not the palaces or the stables. It's the stage after that. So if we're going with palaces as Shlomo and stables as Ahab, this is Yerobam the second, okay? And another thing that shows us the power of the city is this incredible water system that's built. First is a system in the 12th century, but a later system, a more sophisticated system in the 9th century that brings water, okay, in a tunnel actually into the city itself. It's an amazing thing to go and see. Built in the 9th century, again, built by Ahav, okay, so not King Solomon. So just to sum up a little bit, we'll sum up everything at the end, don't worry. But Megiddo, a very good evidence, although again, not everybody agrees, that the gates are from King Solomon. And then a disagreement about, are we talking about Solomonic city and then Ahav, or Ahav and then Yerobam? Okay, and now we're going to go to the one that's perhaps the easiest, okay, and the most conclusive, and that's Hazor. Okay, Hazor in the far north. Hazor is an incredibly important site that is very rarely visited. I don't think I've ever been there with any company, but it's a really, really important site. It's an enormous tell. It's the largest tell in the country, okay? The Canaanite city was the upper city, which you guys are seeing in the picture here, as well as a lower city, which is not really visited today, okay? But it's a massive city that we think had 20,000 people in it at its height, mid-Bronze period, right? We're going to talk about the upper city, a little bit about the Canaanites in Joshua, but mostly about Shlomo. So again, just to understand where we are. So here we are in Tel Chatzor. Okay, again, here is Har Meron and Sfat, not far away. Here is the Kinneret. So if we were crossing on our Via Maris, crossing the Jezreel Valley, right, sort of down here, a little lower, we could cross and go all the way out towards the northeastern kingdoms on the other side of the Jordan, okay, or we could continue up and go through Hazor and then go up, okay, so Hazor is very powerful because of its location. It's at a crossroads, trade with Egypt, trade with Mesopotamia, And that gives it its power. We found artifacts there, gifts that were given from the Egyptian pharaohs to Chatzor. One of the things that hasn't yet been found in Chatzor that everybody is hoping is the Holy Grail that hopefully we'll find one day is an archive, right? Would make sense to find an archive with records of all these different kinds of trade that's happening. It hasn't been found yet, but quite a lot has been found. Okay. It was excavated also by Yigal Yadin. He was in a lot of different places. Today, it's being excavated and restored by Amnon Bentor, who was Yadin's student and excavated him there with him. Okay. And we have a good story about him at the end. There's a Canaanite city on the upper and lower, as we said, destroyed. And then there's a smaller Israelite city that Ahab expands. And then the city is destroyed completely in the year 732 by the Assyrian invasion. And that's it. Chatzor is not rebuilt, right? It waits for its excavator. Sorry, I think that my watch has stopped, which is very bad. So Rabbi Kalman, can you keep me on time?
Yeah, it's 11:50. So you have 10 minutes.
Okay. I was wondering why the time was not moving.
I have a few questions, but not too many. Not so many questions, just if you want to time that. But yeah, it is 11:50. 5:50 in Israel.
Thank you.
6:50 in Israel.
Thank you. Time is 6:50. We're doing good then. All right. So our Canaanite city, Yadin excavated a large, large ritual area. All of it today is in the Israel Museum. Again, showing us this power of the Baal, of the Canaanite religion, something that we saw already in Gezer and in Megiddo. Now, one of the great stories that, one of the great connections between Tanakh and archaeology is in Chatzor. Right? In Tanakh, it tells us about Yoshua's battles. And some of them, as we mentioned in the first class, are very hard to substantiate from archaeology, like Jericho, right? Jericho doesn't seem to have existed in the time of Yoshua. But the battle in Chatzor fits beautifully with archaeology, and Amnon Bentor agrees with this, right? It talks about Chatzor. It's the final set of battles. Yoshua goes with the army up to the north after they've already conquered the area near Jericho and the Ai, after they've conquered the center and the area of the Givonim, and then they go up to battle in the north. Chatzor is Rosh Kol Mamlachot Ele. It's the most important city. And after the conquest, it says Yoshua destroys and burns only Chatzor, right? Only Chatzor is burnt. Now, in the upper city, there is this massive structure, right, which had these two huge pillars in front. These are a reconstruction, obviously. These are wood, but these are enormous pillars. There was an altar in the front, these large walls with, again, mud bricks inside. And this building, which may have been a palace, it may have been a temple, it's not so clear. It is destroyed in a fiery conflagration. When you walk around, you can see the evidence of the fire. You can see charcoal. It clearly was destroyed in a terrible fire in the 1230s, okay? Yoshua is the only real contender for that destruction. There's no other great power in the region who could have done it, and it fits beautifully with the Tanakh stories. From that point, Chatzor is destroyed. Canaanite Chatzor, the massive, incredible city, is no longer. There is a very small Israelite settlement, and then the city itself is rebuilt by, again, is it Shlomo? So here we have a gate area. Here are our lovely proto-aeolic columns. This is in the Israel Museum, a reconstruction. Okay, and here, connected to the gate, we have a casemate wall. Okay, we have this wall with the rooms inside. Okay, the style fits with our time period. Here's our gate. Okay? Again, our beautiful six chambers. Fits perfectly with what we saw in Megiddo, fits with what we saw in Gezer, but it still doesn't tell us if it's necessarily Shlomo. But Amnon Bentor excavated next to the gates. Okay, Yadin excavated the gates. This is where he told his workers, you're going to find these gates. Okay, but Amnon Bentor excavated the wall adjacent to the gate, and he found, like we said, a casemate wall, but he also found a house in the wall. Okay, the house, the top layer is from the 9th century based on the pottery that he found. And then there are three earlier layers, meaning the earliest part of this house in the wall connected to the gate goes back to the 10th century. So this gate fits perfectly with the time period of Shlomo. So Chatzor fits very nicely. All right, before we come to our conclusions, let's just take a look at a couple last things that were uncovered. Okay, there's an important storehouse building from the time of Ahav, the same time as Megiddo, similar style. Okay, and there's also a massive, massive water system, same idea as Megiddo. The great story about the water system is that Yadin kind of sees there's something there. He wants to go and he wants to explore it, but it's kind of late in the day. He finds the opening. He goes to his students and he says, listen, I found the opening. Tomorrow we'll get all the safety equipment and we'll go down there and we'll explore it. Okay. And then he goes home, has dinner and whatever. His students, Bentor and Uzishkin, right? Young guys. They say, we're not waiting until tomorrow. They go down, they look around, and then they leave a little sign that says, Kvar Hayinu Po. We were here already, so that when Yadin comes down, he sees that he is not the first one to enter the system. Okay, so what are our conclusions? There are still a lot of questions, but what it seems is that the gates of Chatzor and Gezer can be dated to King Solomon. The jury is out in Megiddo, but it seems probable that it's King Solomon. Jerusalem needs to be more excavating, but the palace is King Solomon. Meaning, what's the end of our story? The end of our story is we have a lot of proof that King Solomon builds here. Is it as massive as Tanakh depicts it? Is it as powerful and as peaceful as Tanakh depicts it? That we don't know yet, okay? But we do have quite a lot of evidence that shows us that there is a strong and powerful presence in the time of King Solomon. So let's take a look at what are our questions. Questions. All right, let's go back to the front. The corvée, I don't know what you meant by that. So cannot answer, I'm sorry. Finkelstein is a minimalist, yes. Although there are much greater minimalists than he, right? He is a very conservative minimalist. Stonehenge, I don't know what that is about. Have the Israelis requested the return of the calendars from the Turks? The Turks have a few things that we want. If you've been following politics in Israel in the last 10 years, you know that the Turks and us are not such great friends anymore. We used to be. And I think that is probably not the highest on our list, although it would be nice. I am sorry. Yes, I will try to get a better mic than what I have. How many people would have lived in one of these cities? Okay, excellent question, which basically means I don't have the answer. Okay, the question of density of cities is very tricky to answer. Okay, think about, I don't know, Manhattan as compared to, Boulder, Colorado, or somewhere in Montana. How many people are in each city? There's no such thing as density per square mile. It depends where you are and how urban the area is. How much farming can it support? How much water can it support? Certainly Solomon's cities, even at their height, are not big cities, right? We're not talking about tons and tons and tons of people. We're talking about probably in the low thousands. But again, it's a very open question. All right, Armageddon, the war of Gog and Magog, right? We talk about Gog and Magog. The New Testament talks about Armageddon, the war at the end of time. Okay, Rahab lived in the wall, right? Living in the wall. Radiocarbon dating of the stables. I don't believe there was anything organic, well, except for the peeing, that, right? And that answer was here. I don't know if they dated the soil. I am doubting it, but I don't have an answer. Okay, what is the source of the ivory? It's good that everyone answers each other's questions. I don't need to do anything. This is very nice. Okay, ivory, of course, is imported. We don't have any elephants. It's brought here, but yes, exactly. Ivory shows the thriving trade that's going on here. And that's also one of the things that it says about King Solomon, that he has these trade relations, right? Think of the Queen of Sheba and the ivory and the monkeys and all those different things, right? So this is the ivory here that I showed you guys is from the Canaanites. And we do have from later in Israelite times. Is Chatzor six or eight chambers? Six. These are all six. The Canaanite gate in Megiddo is four. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Corvée is the term for the system of forcing people to work for the king. Thank you. I did not know what that was referring to. Standing pillars are like Stonehenge. I am not going to address Stonehenge because I don't know anything about it. Okay. I visited Tel Chatzar. Right. It's developed amazingly. Amnon Bentor, besides being a great archaeologist, is also a very good at preservation and also at fundraising. He's very good at presenting the site in a way that makes it appealing to people. And yeah, it's a great site. I highly, highly recommend visiting. Go to Tzfat, see some artists, and then go to Chatzor. Ivory was also derived from the tusks of wild boars. Is that true? That's so interesting. I did not know that. Okay. First time was in Megiddo was in 1969. Yes, everything, so many archaeological sites in Israel have upped their game, and they really are incredible. So, come. Visit. Other questions that people have, even if you want to ask them, not in the chat, but in, real life, or at what passes for real life.
Okay, I think those tops, those fancy tops of the pillars, remind me of something
the
that was
Aeolic columns, yes.
I think by Scott Strickland, because it looks so familiar, and I go down to the till a lot.
If that's true, it's very new, and I have not heard anything about it, and it would be very, very interesting if it's true, because that's a big deal. But the last ones I heard about were discovered in on the Tayelet, in the Promenade in Jerusalem, and that's a big question. Are we doing any live tour soon? I would love to. What does it say in the corner of the Farmer's Almanac? Oh, it says the name of the guy, Avi. Hey, well, probably what was the name of the guy. Amnon Bentor won the Israel Prize. Oh, hi, Annie Hershkowitz. Is the slideshow available afterwards, Rabbi Kelman?
Yeah, actually, first of all, this is available both to listen, but on YouTube. And if we'll post your sources, you send them, we'll post them on our website also. They're not yet there, but and this should be available. We try to get everything available within 24 hours. That's our goal. Sometimes it's a little tricky on a Friday, but anyways, Thursday to Friday, but we should get it up. And you can watch on YouTube, download. In general, for all our classes, you can go to any of the programs and click, and you'll see the sources for all our shiurim there.
Okay, thank you, everybody. Coming attractions. Next week, you have a question? Oh, that was a thank you. Thank you. Next week, we are going to do not only Tanakh, but we're going to branch out a little bit, and we're going to do underground Jerusalem, the excavations in Jerusalem after the Six-Day War, which range from First Temple to Crusader and afterwards. It's really one of my favorite tours in real life and virtual. So please come. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Shuli. We look forward to seeing you next week. Next online on the Torah Motion Zoom channel, 8:30 this evening, our rotating Parshat HaShavua Shir tonight given by Wendy Amselin. So everybody's invited. That's 8:30 this evening. I'll send out an email. Information next week, Benji Samuels will be giving it, et cetera, et cetera. And then we start on Sunday, of course, a doubleheader. Menachem Liptak continuing his series, and then Rav Rimon, his second two-part series, Be Free Tour. They'll do the last week, he did really the introduction and setting up the issues, the practical applications of robotics and artificial intelligence on Shabbat, and et cetera. I'll also announce now, really, you're hearing it for the first time. We'll send out an email a little bit later. Next Wednesday at 2:15. A different time. We have to work with everybody's schedule. And also, it's nice to try an afternoon class. Lori Novick, who's a neighbor of yours in Efrat. I don't know if you know her, Shuli. You probably know her. Yes. She has spoken a couple times before. She's starting actually what we envision. We don't know exactly an ongoing series. We figure maybe 10 weeks or so. Her and Ilana Sober, those of you from Toronto know her quite well, I would assume she's now back in Israel, but they'll be giving, mainly Lori, but Ilana will give a couple classes, men, women, ritual issues, tefillin, tzitzis, a look at the sources, we'll send them the information. That's going to be starting Wednesday, 2:15, our time, 9:15 in Israel. So just want to give you, those who stay till the end, till after the questions and for all my announcements, get to hear the plugs first. I know not everybody stays, but okay. All right. Very good, everybody. Any questions? Like I always say, if you have ideas and suggestions for speakers, we really are always listen. The Zoom allows us, as we were saying right before the class, really allows us to bring speakers from anywhere in the world. It's an amazing thing. We have to take advantage and the silver lining in the situation that we're in. So I'm always looking for ideas and stuff. I have lots of my own, but it's always good to get ideas from other people. So, and some of our speakers actually have come from some of the participants. So please feel free. We're always interested in your feedback, positive feedback. Any critical feedback is also very good. Constructive feedback, we can always learn from and improve. So thank you very much, everybody. Have a wonderful day. We look forward to seeing you at 8:30 p.m. this evening, if you can make it. Otherwise, see you next week. Thank you.
Thank you. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. That's right. Thursday night.